Of course, the hindmost might quite possibly be India someday, a fact which the Indian seems sometimes to overlook. Nor does there seem to be much virtue in recognizing a regime at the very moment when it is engaged in maltreating American consular officers, to say nothing of doing so at a time when it is engaged in waging war against the Republic of Korea. But for the time being, the conflict, or apparent conflict, between tactics and strategy can be confusing. Let us accordingly try to distinguish as carefully as may be between the two. The more immediate outlook is forbidding. Except for the Indian-Pakistani subcontinent, America and the Western world as a whole have lost their positions on the Asiatic mainland, except for peninsulas and offshore archipelagos. We are holding the peninsulas only by force of arms, our own arms, while the Soviets remain militarily uncommitted. We are having grave difficulty even so, and may lose some of the positions we now hold so precariously. In the process of fighting to hold what positions we do now have, we are alienating some of our most valued friends in Asia. We are faced by a dilemma. The longer we go on fighting, the greater is the danger that we shall lose more friends, and the greater is the danger of our being drawn into the bottomless pit of a major land war in Asia. Yet if we do not fight, we shall certainly lose still more friends. In the end, we shall lose positions of vital importance to our own security, we shall lose the whole system of collective security, and in the end, we shall be drawn into a world war anyway. It is this kind of choices that the world situation is to this kind of choices that the world situation has reduced the West. Yet the outlook is not necessarily hopeless, for it seems possible in the long run to recover or retain the friendship of India, and it is not utterly impossible even that official China too may see someday to be totally hostile, assuming that it is now. In the last analysis, both India and China desperately need things that only the Western world can possibly provide. The Soviet communist system cannot possibly provide these things. Or if it can, then this can be done only at the grievous cost of other members of that system who will hardly rejoice. Nehru knows these things, and Mao Zedong will soon learn them if he has not already done so. There are always ways to bring these facts home. If a great war can be avoided long enough, an American policy strategy is based on a weighing of these great factors of strength and weakness. We must avoid a great war. We must hold on to the positions we now hold on the shores of Asia. We must prove that aggression does not pay in Korea, and therefore that it is not likely to pay anywhere else either. We must also prove that it is not profitable to be solely dependent upon the goodwill of Moscow for the basic needs of life, including the basic need of national and individual self-determination and self-respect. Tito found these things out. Several leading communists elsewhere have found them out, most notably and recently in Italy. The Chinese are not stupid. They will find them out too in time. In time, accordingly, if we pursue a wise policy wisely, a day will come when the Chinese may decide that, after all, they have a choice between dependence on Russia and friendly cooperation with the West, and that the latter state and estate is more pleasant than the former. What is such a wise policy? In broad outline, we can prove to the Chinese communists, as we proved to the Soviets on the Berlin issue, that there are many means short of war by which we can cause acute discomfort to even the most formidable of opponents. We can annoy and harass and upset the communists and make it difficult and expensive for them to govern and keep them off balance and slow down and stop their aggressive imperialist expansion. We can do these things by diplomatic and political and economic and psychological warfare, by raids on Peking's trade and currency and treasury, by preemptive buying and boycotts, by propaganda and subversion and sabotage, and by giving economic and other support to anti-communist forces in China, and by a host of other means short of all-out war. At the same time, or at a suitable later time, we can proffer proof that it is a pleasant and profitable and proper thing to be on good terms with the United States. The Chinese, as I have said, are as capable as any people are of drawing the logical conclusions from a state of affairs like this and acting on them. Let us consider now another general field of American foreign policy today, the field which embraces, or should I say encloses, Germany, Japan, Yugoslavia, and Spain. I include all four of these countries in one field of policy because I think it may fairly be said that the same principle determines our policy vis-a-vis all four. Within the quite startlingly recent past, all four of these states were America's enemies in varying degrees. Seldom, perhaps, have such large numbers of Americans loathed other countries more bitterly than they loathed Germany and Japan 6 years ago. Seldom, perhaps, have so many Americans been so angry with another government as so many Americans were with Marshal Tito's government 4 years ago. Spain has probably been less generally and less passionately detested, but there can have been few occasions during the latter years of the Second World War when General Franco could have won very many popularity contests in large parts of the United States. Yet what do we now behold? We behold the spectacle of one of our most beloved and respected national heroes, General Eisenhower, going out of his way to assure the Germans that he, for one, is convinced that the German army never lost its honor under Nazi rule. We behold the spectacle of the American authorities in Germany releasing fairly considerable numbers of men who had been found guilty of some of the most horrible abominations ever perpetrated by human beings upon human beings. We behold the spectacle of the United States government insisting that the West Germans must be armed and offering inducements to the Germans if they will only arm, insisting so vehemently for a time as to risk alienating allies who had hardly begun to recover and never will entirely recover from 3 to 4 years of experience with the German army and with the conquests, concentration camps, and crematoria which it conferred upon so many of Europe's peoples. I do not wish to dwell too insistently on this point, to labor it or to belabor it. I remind you merely that we are now well launched upon similar reversals of policy in respect of Japan, Yugoslavia, and Spain. In the eyes of many Americans, and in official policy, these countries have ceased to be enemies and have become friends, or potential friends. We have ceased our attempts to beat them down and hold them down, and have embarked upon determined efforts to build them up and hold them up. Parenthetically, I am omitting Italy from this consideration because Italy is a special case, differing essentially, it seems to me, from these other four. It is easy to become indignant about these things. It is difficult to refrain from satire. Perhaps we should be indignant, but above all, we must be coolly and even cold-bloodedly objective in our consideration of these matters. Let us consider objectively, then, certain aspects of our national policies toward these former enemies. We have said that the ally of today must inevitably tend to become the enemy of tomorrow, and the enemy of today, the ally of tomorrow. But this is not the case of all enemies or of all allies indiscriminately. Enemies become allies only insofar as allies become enemies, and only to the extent that support may be needed against allies turned enemies. That is, an ally is useful only to the extent that there is need for support which he can and will provide. I apologize for even mentioning anything so obvious. My excuse must be that the point is in grave danger of being completely lost sight of, obvious though it may be. Let us revert to the first principles of our argument. Clearly, the Soviets, who were the ally, are now the enemy. They themselves proclaim it. Their conduct bears them out. I submit that we must do them the honor of taking them seriously. We have even less excuse, if such a thing be possible, for mistaking their purposes than we ever had for mistaking Hitler's. The strange alliance during the war, as General Dean has described it, was a strange alliance indeed. It was hardly an alliance at all. It has been called a marriage of convenience, but it was not that either. It was not an act of will. It was a coincidence. We were both set upon by the same enemy. We both perforce undertook to destroy the enemy. We did destroy the enemy. We destroyed, that is, the principal, if not the only bond which joined us. Thereupon we reverted to a cordial distrust and detestation of each other. Thus we need allies. But we need allies we can count on to stand by us to some useful purpose in case of need. And other nations will do this only if it is in their vital interest to do so. This interest will be composed of various factors, but the first of these factors will be each nation's survival and independence. Can each nation's survival and independence be best promoted by a clear-cut American superiority of strength or victory over Russia, or by a precarious balance between the two superstates, or by Russian superiority or victory? These are some of the questions which the others will weigh most carefully in determining their national policies, and which we too, therefore, must most carefully weigh in calculating what their policies are likely to be. The others will also weigh another category of power factors. Thus, they will ask themselves how strong the United States seems to be and seems to feel that it is. If America is too weak, or thinks itself too weak, to stand up to the Soviets, then others will be much inclined to come to terms with the Kremlin. If these others can make deals with the Kremlin or can stay neutral, and if we need them, then the question arises whether we ought to make it worth their while to become our allies. But even in these cases, it is hardly the best tactic to beg the others to be on our side. This is a betrayal of weakness, or at the very least of a sense of weakness. It may discourage the others from wishing to be on our side. It will certainly encourage them to exact the highest possible price for their collaboration. And if the others cannot make a deal with the Kremlin, or even remain neutral, but must be on our side in any event, then surely it is improvident to pay them for their collaboration. Surely, moreover, this will be most peculiarly the case if the others are nearer the danger than we are and in greater peril than this country. It is all very well to count noses of possible allies and bayonets and bazookas and bombers, but it is also necessary to consider whether you can depend upon these possible allies, and if so, for what and how much. Consider, for example, Spain. One of Europe's most gallant and most famous field marshals said to some of us at luncheon not so long ago in Washington that he understood Franco has an army of, and I quote, 500,000 cutthroats. The field marshal exulted over the prospect which this fact conjured up before his eyes. 500,000 cutthroats, he exclaimed. That's what I want, 500,000 cutthroats. The field marshal spoke contemptuously of politicians, that is, responsible civilian ministers who had expressed misgivings on this score. He wanted this force, he made it clear to us, in order to be able to fight the Russians more effectively, if fight he must, and he sneered at politicians who wished to make haste slowly in recruiting Franco's cutthroats. He said that Western Europe must have these valued Spanish allies on its side, paying, if necessary, a suitable price to secure their services. This view of the eminent field marshals seemed to some of us to be perhaps just a teensy-weensy bit too sanguine and too simplified. It seemed to leave certain relevant questions unanswered. To take just one, it seemed to leave unanswered the question, assuming that Franco does indeed command 500,000 cutthroats, whose throats would these brave fellows cut if opportunity afforded? Our common enemy's throats? Or would they perhaps cut their fellow Spaniards' throats? Or each other's? Or might they conceivably, by any remote, unlikely chance, cut ours? These affairs are much more complicated than even the most gallant field marshals seem sometimes to suppose. Nations do not act out of love and affection for other nations. They act on a calculation of their own interest, and above all, of their own independence and survival. We must do the same. Why should we help Tito, we are asked? He's a communist, isn't he? Presumably he is. At least he apparently considers himself one, even if he has been excommunicated and anathematized by those who claim to be better judges of such matters. In any event, let us grant, for the sake of the argument, that Tito is indeed a communist. From our point of view, that is, presumably he is a so-and-so. But Tito hates Stalin, and Stalin hates Tito. While Tito is accordingly a so-and-so, he is, in a certain sense and in a certain measure, our so-and-so. It is a case, if you like, of dog eat dog, although our diplomatists would shudder to hear the case put so coarsely. It is better for us to have the two dogs at each other's throats than it is to have them both at ours. It is as simple as that. It may be objected again that this view of the case is cynical. If so, it can be put in other terms. It can be said that we believe in national independence for the Yugoslavs, that we want all peoples liberated from the yoke of Moscow. So we do. It can also be said that we believe in the widest possible diffusion of power throughout the world, because peace and security are then more easily preserved. We believe this too. But our first consideration is, I hope, our own survival. I don't think that this is cynical. I don't see that there is anything cynical about facts or about a survival. I put it to you that we need to be more cynical, if that is the correct term, or let us say realistic or objective, if you prefer, if we are to survive.